Well, thank you, John, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. You are my 74th guest, Brigadier General John Tykert. How are you today?
Garrett, I am doing great. I am so honored to be with you. Your podcast is prolific. I can't believe I'm number 74, and keep going. You're killing it.
Thank you so much for the kind words. Really appreciate it. And I'm so happy to have you on today. Brigadier General Tykert, when you think of relationship building in a team environment, what does relationship building mean to you, John, and what has it meant for your professional career?
Garrett, there is a huge problem that exists in society where there is $9 trillion of lost global GDP because of employee disengagement. That means people don't feel valued, they don't feel heard, they don't feel that they're part of something greater than themselves. $9 trillion lost global productivity. And that all can be resolved. And frankly, an organization can have a competitive advantage when they focus on making sure that people are heard, that people feel valued, that people are part of something and understand that they're part of something greater than themselves. And it really has been true throughout my career that when I have an opportunity to lead and you create a culture or an environment where, again, you value relationships, you build a team, and you engage people, then now you unlock talent and you unleash the team and you see productivity and quality of life that is skyrocketing because you do those things that are exactly what your podcast is all about.
Well, I really appreciate that to provide the context for my listeners and viewers at home. Walk me through, and for my audience, walk me through your career. What inspired you to want to join the military? And you have such an incredible background. Please also discuss what type of missions you were on that really come to mind. Obviously, the accolades, the awards speak for themselves, but it was such an impressive resume you have just doing my research. But for my audience at home and for me, to just walk me through all that and touch upon relationship building in the process.
Garrett, I appreciate that. And thanks for those kind words about accolades. But frankly, anything I have ever done has been as a part of a team, and any accolades I've gotten have been part of what the team has achieved as well. I grew up in the very northwest portion of the country. Port Angeles is the name of the town, in a patriotic, loving home. And I thought that I wanted to be in the military, but I wasn't quite sure. And then literally in 1986, as an eighth grade boy, I went to my small theater in my small town and watched the movie Top Gun, the original Top Gun, and decided then and there that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And I did a little bit of research in which service had the best airplanes. At the time, the F-15E Strike Eagle was coming out, and put posters of that on my wall and said, that's what I want to do with my life. I want to serve my country and be a fighter pilot for the Air Force. I went through ROTC at MIT. I commissioned into the Air Force and went to pilot training and ended up getting the chance to fly that F-15E Strike Eagle as a two-assignment combat pilot, combat in Iraq and combat in the former Yugoslavia. And then I decided that I wanted to become a test pilot, which means testing new aircraft. So I went to test pilot school, and it kind of fuses engineering and operational skill together in one skill set and became an F-22 test pilot. And then did that for several assignments and leadership opportunities. And my last four assignments were leading and commanding Joint Base Andrews, the President's Airfield just outside of Washington, D.C., and then commanding Edwards Air Force Base, a place that I call the center of the aerospace testing universe, where Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in 1947. And we've been doing aviation firsts ever since there at that location. I ended up being our nation's senior defense official to Iraq, deployed for 14 months during COVID from May of 2020 to July of 2021, and then came back to a Pentagon job running international affairs for the Air Force and the Space Force, and then retired about 2.5 years ago because I felt this burning desire that there was something more impactful I could do with my life to serve my country by getting out than staying in. And I've dabbled in a variety of keynote speaking, a lot of writing, including author of 3 books. I do some consulting, a lot of national security media engagements on Fox News and News Nation. I ran for U.S. Senate here in Maryland. But really, to me, it's always been about that oath that I first took as a 17-year-old when I showed up at MIT to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. By the way, I happen to do so alongside of a particularly attractive ROTC cadet that now has been my wife for almost 28 years. But to me, it's always been about serving my country as a part of an amazing team. And all of that requires strong relationships that you've got to be deliberate and intentional about building.
Of course, and it's so wonderful that that's how you met your wife. You know, that is such a special story. And you know, you talk about your early days at MIT, one of the most finest schools in the world. Talk to me about those early days at MIT and how your education shaped you for a lifetime of service in the U.S. Air Force.
Yeah, Garrett, a little bit of going to MIT and going into the Air Force was not just to fly that F-15E Strike Eagle, but also to be a test pilot, which I ended up getting the opportunity to do. And that time at MIT and really going through the rigors of an analytical mindset helped prepare me a lot for being a test pilot, but also really just an ability to assess what's going on in the world around me in a rigorous analytical type of perspective, and then making decisions based on that. Really, that was a foundation. You know, I came from this small town, a logging community in the northwest portion of the country, but the opportunity to rub shoulders with and be dazzled by these world-class minds that I was able to spend time with really gave me an opportunity to shape a worldview and a perspective. Of course, finding my wife there was the best thing that it gave me. But all of those other things certainly played a role as well. And I actually just want to jump in regarding my family. We have three kids, Garrett. The oldest one just commissioned into the Air Force after graduating from Baylor. She's a recruiter now for a few months, but will go be a pilot in the Air Force. She'll go to pilot training soon. My middle daughter wants to be an agent in the FBI. And I literally, just before filming right now, dropped my son off at the airport here in Baltimore, Washington International, to go to a Navy boot camp before he goes to do Navy ROTC at Vanderbilt in the fall. And really, I just love the idea that what my wife and I have done is not just raise up really good human beings, which they are, but people that have a desire to serve as a part of something greater than themselves. And again, all of that comes back to you don't do any of that by yourself. You can't support and defend the Constitution by yourself. You do so with teams, and when you have an opportunity to lead like I have, you've got to be very intentional and deliberate about the type of culture you create as a team, and then making sure that you're building relationships so that those people that have an opportunity to work as a part of that team and you alongside of them can be raised up to become the best possible version themselves and go on and do other great things. But it really does come back to relationship and team building at the central core of what I have spent my life doing. And it warms my heart to see that my kids desire to follow in those footsteps as a part of a team doing something important as well.
Absolutely. And for you and your wife, you must be so proud to see your three kids, you know, follow in your and your wife's footsteps, looking and yearning for serving our country valiantly and, you know, going through the proper channels and steps and eventually, you know, have their own stories to tell about serving their country. And it's so prideful for you and your wife, I would imagine, knowing that they wanted to honor your family by also taking these bold steps to serve our country, not knowing where after their, you know, educational training and, you know, where they might have to be based out of, whether domestically or abroad. Will they see combat or will they be in peacetime? So there's a lot of faith as well, you know, very faith-filled decision-making process. Is this right for my child? Although I did this for my country and my wife did this for my country, is this for our children? And the fact is that all three of your children want to do this, and I'm sure it brings you a lot of joy, and that, you know, you and your wife will be counseling them along the way about, you know, what it means to live up to that potential.
It does, Garrett. And going back to what I started talking about with, which is this $9 trillion deficit because of employee disengagement, it reminds me of a story of a really good friend of mine from college who went on to go work on Wall Street. And I went into the military. And every time we get together, while he makes a lot more money than me, probably 40 times more than me, he's some big muckety-muck in some big investment bank in New York, he always expresses a little bit of jealousy about me or about us for two primary reasons. Number one, he knows that I have a broader purpose in life, that I'm tied into something that really matters. Not that he doesn't, but he doesn't really feel the tie into that. And then secondly, every time I talk about my experiences in the military, I talk about the team that I've worked with. And it's more like a family than it is a work environment. And we share successes and we bear burdens and we know one another's families. And you know, it goes back to the idea that if you do two things as a leader that are both related to relationship and team building, then you tap into something that is innate in human nature, that you help people understand that they're tied into something greater than themselves. For my family, it's support and defend the Constitution of the United States. For other families and other people, it can be a lot of different things, but you need to tie your employees and your team into something that really matters. And then you build this environment that is all about helping people become the best possible version of themselves. And that means caring for them. That means challenging them. That means correcting them. That means inspiring them. And that friend of mine is jealous of me and us, not because I fly cool planes, though I did, but because I'm part of an organization that has purpose and meaning and that cares for one another. All leaders, no matter where you are and what field you are in, can develop those things, but it takes intentionality in their workplaces. And if you do, you now engage employees. But it goes back to what this podcast is all about, Garrett, which is relationship and team building. And if you do a good job at that in those two ways that I just described, then again, you unlock innate human talent and you unleash your team to go on and do amazing things that you could only dream of.
And it's great that you were able to, provide that example and, be respectful about it and be intentional about how you wanted to explain that because, I actually come from the investment banking background. I worked with my father. We had a family business and he's since retired and I was with him for over 8 years. But I also felt that the investment banking industry, it could be very lonely at times because your purpose is, represent a client, partner them with an investor or a lender and help raise capital for them, obviously get some big project off the ground. And you hope that that project, that endeavor, whatever it might be, can create jobs, could improve the livelihoods of like so many families who are tied to that project. And it's a calling that I had at one time, but with this podcast and going back to my journalism roots and interviewing all of my guests and people who are either tied to sports or media, business, politics, and now I've extended to people like you, like my good friend of almost 15 years now, Shelley Brunswick, who's a retired lieutenant colonel of the U.S. Air Force, former chief operations officer at the Space Foundation, lifetime member of the Forbes Technology Council, and she has her own enterprise now. And I wanted to bring these RMOs, as you call them, offline, and I want you to, if you'd be so kind, to explain the significance of these. One of Shelley's colleagues in the U.S. Air Force gave me one of these RMOs from during my time in D.C. I was a former intern on Capitol Hill for a U.S. congressman from North Carolina. I also worked at NBC Universal and went to school for a summer at Georgetown University. So I had spent a lot of time in D.C. This was another RMO. Your counterpart, Michael Sloan, retired Brigadier General of the U.S. Army. So this is the one right here. And then this is, I don't know if you would consider it an RMO, but Shelley had provided this to me, and it's just a Space Foundation commemorative coin of 30-year anniversary at the time. But I look at these coins or these RMOs, and it brings me great pride. And interestingly enough, I remember the specific date when I received the RMO from Brigadier General Sloan of the Army. It was on October 9th of 2018. I was flying back from Washington, D.C. with my father. We were on a business trip. And then 2 days later, here back in Central Florida, I live in the Orlando, Florida area. My wife and I are a son, but I met my wife on October 11, 2018. So it was a big week of, meeting Brigadier General Sloan, receiving that RMO, and then meeting my wife 2 days after on October 11th of that year. But could you explain to me and my audience at home the significance of these when civilians receive RMOs like these. And again, the relationship building podcast of what this is, relationship building in a team environment, what does that mean from a relationship building standpoint when you have civilians receiving these RMOs from people like you who have served a lifetime? And what does it say about identifying civilians for these particular RMOs as a kind gesture?
Garrett, absolutely. Let me touch on two quick things and I'll specifically answer your question. Back to the investment banking or whatever it is that your listeners are doing, there is a higher purpose to that. All of these elements of our society are necessary for society to function. We just need leaders to be intentional about helping the members of their team understand that how what they are doing, sometimes in the trenches in a very difficult environment, say in Manhattan for my friend, links up to something that really matters for our society, our country. That's point number one. Point number two, I reflect a lot back, especially now that we enter our 250th year as a country, back in American history. And what you just said reminded me of something that Alexis de Tocqueville said when he came over here from France in the 1830s. He came over here to study what was so special about America. Two things that he found. Number one, there was something about our faith connection that really was powerful that he had never seen before. And number two, he saw people in communities all over this country bonding together to solve problems within their community. Different people in the same community bonding together as a part of our team, a team to solve problems. And I think, again, that goes back to this idea that the power of connectivity to something that is important and doing something together with others can really solve problems. And de Tocqueville saw those types of things as something that was magnificent and powerful about this country, unique to his experience from France. Go into those things that I call RMOs. Most people would call them coins. We in my fighter pilot community call them RMOs, or round metallic objects. That you call them that because when you're in an organization like a squadron, then you are required to carry one of your squadron's RMOs with you wherever you go. In fact, throughout my career, I always carried two. I carried my first squadron's RMO. I carried with throughout my career at all times in my wallet. And then you always carry, or at least I always carried my current squadron's RMO. You call them RMO because when you're in this squadron environment, anybody at any time can pull out their RMO and challenge everybody that is within the sound of their voice. And as it turns out, if they challenge and everyone else produces their coin, their RMO, then they've got to buy a round for everybody. Anyone who's missing their RMO has to buy a round for everybody. And you call it an RMO, not a coin, because just saying the coin word, the C word, the coin word, is an automatic challenge. So you don't actually ever say coin, because it is an automatic challenge to everybody that is within the sound of your voice. Interestingly enough, going back in history, I've been told that coins or RMOs came into existence in fighter squadrons during World War II, where one of the individuals that was flying out of England got shot down behind enemy lines, I think got captured or rescued by the French resistance, and tried to say, look, I'm a American fighter pilot, please don't execute me or imprison me. Get me back to my squadron. And they didn't believe him. And the only way that he was able to prove that he was an American is that someone from that organization had made medallions or coins and handed them out to everybody as a gift. He had his, and it had the squadron's name on it. And they believe that he was really an American fighter pilot because he pulled out his RMO, which is why you got to carry it everywhere. So that's a little bit of the tradition. By the way, what an awesome idea for team building and relationship building is you've got, I carried those two coins with me everywhere, every bit of my time in the military, my first one and my current one. When you get those as an outsider from the squadron, whether you're a civilian or another military member, it means that you have done something exceptional, that you have done something exceptional for the squadron or in the mind of the leader of that organization. And so the fact that you have just displayed three of those, Garrett, is an indication of at least three times people that had their own coins recognized the exceptional nature of what you did and gave you one of their very prized possessions, which essentially makes you an adjunct part of their organization. And it goes back to this idea that now you're part of this team that's bigger than yourself because you did something that was exceptional. A leader recognized it and gave you what looks just like a RMO, a round metallic object, but really it's a sign of your exceptional work and the fact that they would like you to be an adjunct part of their team. But that's a little bit about the history of RMOs and the team building nature of what goes on inside a unit and then why they're given out and they are always given out for something that is exceptional.
Well, I really appreciate the kind words. And I really appreciate the explanation. I mean, that means a lot to me. And I know that you mentioned the two coins that you carry around, and please go into detail about those. I'm looking at this coin and I remember, if my memory serves me well, when it was given to me, on the back of the coin, it mentions integrity, service, courage, and excellence presented by 1st Special Operations Wing Commander Herbert Field, Florida, for excellence. And the front of the coin, 1st Special Operations Wing, anytime, any place, Air Commandos. And I remember the gentleman who was Shelley's colleague, and this was in DC, he said that this unit is the same unit, and if my memory serves me well, that carried or transported the Navy SEALs to capture and execute Osama bin Laden. And I thought that was very significant.
Yep.
When I was, 22 years old and I'm an intern on Capitol Hill and I'm hearing this, and I'm receiving a coin like this, it was pretty, sobering and humbling to receive, such a coin when I never even knew at the time that these existed. And I said coin again, it's a habit, but I mean RMOs.
Nope, all good. You're excused from the exact vernacular of how we use these things. I had a really good friend and colleague, actually. She was my vice wing commander when I was the wing commander at Joint Base Andrews, who went on to go command the 1st Special Operations Wing there out of Hurlburt Field, Jocelyn Schermerhorn. Phenomenal officer and leader. And that unit is indeed extremely special. And I have no doubt that they played the role that you described. Let me talk about my first squadron, because that's the one that I carried with me all the time. I would swap out the second coin or RMO for whatever unit I was in at the time, but I always carried that first one. And I showed up in 1997 at RAF Lakenheath in the United Kingdom as a young lieutenant, a young F-15E pilot, and it was my first, after all of the training, pilot training and F-15 training, my first operational unit. And there was something special about that unit. They happened to have a World War II heritage. And so on that RMO was a bird that was looking through a bomb site, like a Norton bomb site from World War II, like the B-17s and B-24s carried to drop their bombs on targets in mainland Europe. But it had that bird looking through that bomb site on one side. It had the official squadron logo on the other side with 492nd Fighter Squadron. But the thing I remember about that squadron, there's two most. One, it was my first, and we got combat experience both in Iraq and the former Yugoslavia there as a part of that squadron as a young F-15E pilot. But two, we had a leader named Junior Summonsby, who has since retired, and he and I still keep in touch, that was extremely intentional and deliberate about developing leaders within the squadron, but also intentional and deliberate about creating this family-like environment within our unit. And I think I've said before that one of the things that I have found very compelling about my time in the military, and I try to duplicate it everywhere I go as a leader, is helping people feel valued and listened to and considered, and helping them to understand they're part of something greater than themselves. And when you do that, you create this family environment where I know the families of the team members that I work with. They know mine. I know their challenges. I know their struggles. I know their successes. We share in all of those burdens and the opportunity to celebrate. And Junior Summonsby especially did such a good job at, though he was the senior member of the organization, helping us all feel listened to and valued and part of something greater than themselves. And I look back at my time, not just as an F-15E pilot, but as a budding leader, and I so value and benefited from his deliberate nature of developing leaders and creating a family environment that cared for one another. That is exactly what is necessary to allow a team to thrive. Our team thrived And actually, a large number of us still keep in touch with one another some 30 years later almost because of the environment that he created back in 1997.
Incredible story, and thank so much for sharing that with me and my audience. Really appreciate it. And it just speaks to, again, you know, the relationship building aspect. And this is the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building and team environment. This is what I always say: relationship building is the essence of humanity. And as men and women, you know, of planet Earth, and we live here in the United States, I mean, relationship building has to be intentional. It has to be deliberate. There has to be a lot of focus and discipline and a thought process that is, you know, very not calculated, but it has to be, again, intentional. You have to be able to, whether it's taking care of your team in a professional setting, whether it's taking care of your family in the home life, and whomever you come across with. In your case, a lot of missions you were on in the military, and would love to hear more about the ones that really have stuck with you, the ones that were so meaningful, the ones where you felt they were a pivotal moment in your career. Care to share some of these missions that you were on as a fighter pilot, someone who has had to, you know, conduct, along with his colleagues, conduct missions that we don't typically hear about, right? They're not for the public eye. They're not for the public forum, but it's something that you can, you know, publicly talk about for the purpose of this podcast and give us insight, because we've all seen, and you mentioned it earlier about Top Gun and then the sequel Top Gun, the Maverick movie. So would love to know, is that, how much of that is realistic? How much of that really showcases what you actually did in real life?
Garrett, one thing that someone mentioned to me long ago that has stuck with me is that if you want to do something fast, you do it alone. If you want to do something that lasts, you do it with a team. And I certainly see my career as doing things that lasted, because it wasn't just me out there doing something incredible. I was part of a team doing something incredible. And because of that, it had meaning and purpose and it lasted. And I do love the movie set of Top Gun. I mentioned how it frankly changed my life as an eighth grade boy. A little cute story. My wife is a chemistry professor at the Naval Academy. And when Top Gun 2 came out, Top Gun Maverick, they showed it there to a group of midshipmen and faculty members about a week before it came out in the studio, or it came out on movie theater screens. And so, of course, I found my way to get to watch it a week early. But the thing that really struck me, Garrett, was that while I was watching that movie that I love, I'm sitting next to my son, who was the same age watching Top Gun 2 as I was when Top Gun 1 changed my life. And that was just this full circle moment that was absolutely incredible. But the one thing that I don't like about Top Gun is that it focuses a little bit too much on the singular individuals and not as much as it really should on the team. That obviously he, Tom Cruise, is a bit of a maverick by the nature of what the movie is entitled. But I really like the idea that all of the things that they do in the movies aren't about one person. If you really understood the real stories about things like that, you would learn that it is a big team. And I'm talking not just the big team of a group of pilots, but I'm talking about the pilots. I'm talking about the maintainers. I'm talking about the logisticians that get the bombs to the aircraft or the fuel to the aircraft on time. I'm talking about the engineers that developed that capability. I'm talking about the civil engineers that built the roads and the buildings that are being operated out of. I'm talking about the security force members that defend that capability so that the adversary can't do it harm. And there's so many others. And I do think that Top Gun sometimes glorifies the individual hero. But in my experience, and one that is combat and maybe one that is test or flight test, the combat one, maybe a most memorable time was after I had had a few combat sorties under my belt in the former Yugoslavia. If your team or your listeners go back and do a little bit of historical study, in 1999, the West fought a war against the former Yugoslavia, or Serbia in particular. because they were slaughtering some ethnic minorities in Kosovo. And so we were using air power to bring that to an end. And we did successfully, I think, in 78 days of an air power only war. But I remember getting a few of those combat sorties under my belt. I remember that I was always out there as a part of, as a young wingman, a four ship, maybe an eight ship that had the other support assets like air refueling aircraft or jamming aircraft that were there that were around us. And getting some of those repetitions and having surface-to-air missiles shot at me or anti-aircraft artillery shot at me and maneuvering to avoid out of the way. And then I had a young officer, a female officer, who had never flown a combat sortie in my back seat after I had had several. And I remember us achieving that mission together. Gina Sabrick is her name. She's now a two-star general in the United States Air Force, doing a phenomenal job. But I remember then feeling honored that someone had made the decision that her first combat sortie would be as my backseater as a weapon system officer. And that really struck me that, guess what? I was never out there doing the combat mission on my own. I was always part of that larger force that I described. But then realizing that I had a part in developing a next generation combat leader and combat weapon system officer was a huge honor. She shacked the target. That means hit it exactly where it was needed. In fact, I think that first combat sortie, she and I, in our bomb that we dropped, destroyed a iron and steel production facility in Serbia that produced something like 10% of their export revenue as a country. And we destroyed it on that day. But it really struck me again that it's that big package that you're a part of. And when you have an opportunity to develop someone else, make sure that you don't develop them into a lone ranger or a singleton hero, but develop them as a part of this broader team. And then very quickly, I was a flight test pilot or a test pilot in the F-22, and I remember having the privilege of dropping the first bomb ever off of an F-22 in test. And I remember that there was this large control room of about 30 people on the ground that were monitoring all of the parameters. I felt very fortunate to be able to be the one that was in the aircraft dropping that bomb. But maybe the one thing that struck me about how small my role was compared to the bigger role was that I dropped that bomb and then waited the time of flight until it would impact. And then I'm waiting to hear from the control room, how did we do? Did it hit the target, this first bomb ever dropped off of the F-22 Raptor or not? And so finally I keyed the microphone and said, hey, control, this is Raptor One. What's the status of the bomb? And then when they came back to transmit to me, I heard that they were already having a party without me because they were celebrating the success, the 30 of them down in the control room. And I thought, well, what about me? I'm the one that dropped the bomb. But the truth of the matter is, we all did. And it was just me up there in the aircraft with a chase aircraft and a tanker and some other things that are around me. But they were the bulk of the mission down there watching the screens from the control room. And it was just a powerful reminder that though I had the glory position maybe as the quarterback on that day, it was really the success of the team that mattered.
And everybody had a unique role in that mission. And I love how you say that, although I dropped the bomb, we all did. And it's because that, again, it doesn't matter what your role is on that day and in that mission, you're doing it as a team and you recognize each person's contribution because, again, it takes a team to have a successful mission and it takes a lot of trust. And whether in real life, in your case, or as it shows in the movie, which you had said that you wish that it didn't show so much about the singular focus of any one particular individual, but it showed the relationship building aspect of everybody working as a team. Because in the US Air Force, especially when you're flying these magnificent planes and the US military is the greatest fighting force in the world. I mean, it takes a lot of intellect. It takes a lot of understanding how this machinery works and the power and the capabilities of these machines. And you have to be able to, and you're taking orders from above and you have to be so precise. I mean, precision is such an operative word. And, your call letters or your caller sign is Dragon. So talk me about how you got the name Dragon and how fitting it is for the missions, including the one that you just talked about, how fitting it is for your name.
Yeah, thank you for that, Garrett. And let me circle back a little bit to something that you just jogged a small brain cell on. And that is, if your audience wants to watch a real life Top Gun, not the movies, which are awesome, but real life, there is a relatively new Netflix movie that came out, US Air Force Thunderbirds, Our Demonstration Team. And it is the best flying footage I have ever seen. But it also oozes with leadership lessons, team building, relationship building lessons. In fact, they talk a lot about blind trust in that documentary, and I think your listeners will love it. And one of the things that I love extra about that is that the guy who's the squadron commander, Astro Elliott, has been a guy that I have been mentoring since he was a captain in 2012. He's killing it then as the squadron commander of the Thunderbirds. He's moved on to other jobs in the Air Force. And now he is a mentor for my daughter who just entered the Air Force. And so going back to one of these other full circle moments is that I mentored him. He's inspiring people through that movie that your viewers and listeners should watch. And then now he is mentoring my daughter. That's what happens when you build relationships in a community. That's the first thought. I'll get to Dragon in a second. The second thought is, we just a couple weeks ago marveled at this B-2 strike in Iran. We marveled at what those seven B-2s did in destroying those targets in Natanz and Fordow and Isfahan. But something that I think was really good that came out of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, his call sign is Raisin Dan Kane, General Kane, and the Secretary of Defense, was in some of those conferences they had, they talked about the bigger picture of the team. They talked about the engineers that had been studying the target set in Fordow for a decade and a half so that they knew exactly how to destroy that Iranian nuclear capability. They talked about how it wasn't just seven B-2s, but 125 aircraft that rendezvoused after those B-2s flew halfway around the world, mostly without communication, so that they could do the mission together with 77 munitions and 125 different aircraft. It's not just those B-2 pilots that did an amazing thing on that day. It was the broader team. And that's just another great example, both that Thunderbirds movie on Netflix and the B-2 strike in Iran from several weeks ago that I think parlays into this idea of the importance of the team. You get your call sign, like I got my call sign in your first operational assignment. I got mine there in the 492nd Fighter Squadron at RAF Lakenheath. And actually, it's usually based on something stupid that you did, but it has to sound cool. Dragon sounds super cool. The only thing that I'm going to share with your listeners is that it has to do with Zaragoza, Spain, and nuclear weapons. And I'll leave it at that, why I am Dragon. But the esprit de corps building activity is that about 6 months into your first operational squadron, they bring in the new young officers. And they have gathered stories about you for the last several months. And then they have a naming ceremony. And it's like that ceremony is your baptism into being an official part of the squadron. And while there's a lot of hoopla that goes around this naming ceremony, you don't have a say in your own name. They use these silly stories or buffoonery about you to come up with a cool sounding name. But when you walk out of that naming ceremony, then now you have a call sign, and it's like you now have been officially baptized into the squadron. And you're now, even though you're a young lieutenant at the time, you're an official part of the team. And you knew that it was coming, and you were looking forward to it. And now there was some sort of ceremony that created the formal acceptance of you as a part of the team. And I think just that idea, in whatever way in your team, out there as a listener, you can translate some level of esprit de corps and fun and community building activities like icebreakers that build the team and welcome new members into the team, creates a powerful cultural signal that now a new person fully belongs. And that's a little bit the background of how people get call signs and why I'm Dragon.
That is awesome. I appreciate the story and how you came to be known as Dragon. Very special, really brings a lot of insight. And I'm so glad you brought up the recent mission for the B-2 bombers bombing those three uranium-enriched sites in Iran. Do you feel that the B-2 bombers will be needed again to try to keep Iran away from a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, so now we're getting into my bread and butter, Garrett, which is international affairs and national security. I did mention that I do a lot of national security related interviews on places like Fox News and News Nation and others. And if I look back in the end of that 12-day war, there's a couple of thoughts. And the first thought is that the original reason why the Ayatollah decided to negotiate during those 60 days was because he was fearful for the longevity of his regime, primarily because their economy is in shambles because of sanctions. And the reason he started the negotiating pathway is because he was worried that he would be toppled as the supreme leader. And I think now, after the war, though there's a lot of talk about what they may or may not do, that with snapback sanctions on the horizon for October that would make things much worse for Iran, with their economy being in shambles before the war and now much worse after the war, that I really think he has the incentive to make a deal to trade away his nuclear program instead of the continued bluster that would allow him to keep it and then face the wrath of more B-2s and more strikes by the Israeli Defense Force. That's number one. Number two, that I know there's been a lot of debate about what did we destroy? Was it a successful strike? And there's a lot of political reasons for both sides of the aisle to say either it worked well or it didn't. But there's a nonpartisan, nonprofit group called the International Institute for Science and International Security that gives expertise into situations like this. And they have said that Iran's nuclear program has essentially been destroyed or effectively destroyed as a result of what happened during those 12 days, including the B-2 strike. And I lend a lot of credence to their open source, nonpartisan, nonprofit expertise as they've weighed in on this topic.
Of course, and obviously it's important to take a nonpartisan look. And I think that, or I believe that it remains to be seen. I believe it was a successful mission. And I'm sure you being a member of the military and recently retired, but you have access to a lot of intelligence that civilians like me and others who, wouldn't have access to it because we only have access to what we're reading or what we're watching on TV. Just from your expert opinion, how could we prevent any acts of war from Iran where they're trying to harm military members overseas, bases overseas? You hear about sleeper cells, people in the United States from a domestic, standpoint. How can we protect ourselves here at home and be vigilant? Because, every action there is going to be a reaction, right? So is it something that we have to just, again, be mindful of and how we protect ourselves home and abroad from, foreign enemies and just making sure that, we stay safe and that we don't have any type of catastrophic damage, whether to, the homeland, because these foreign terrorists, they're trying to affect our economy, they're trying to affect our way of life, our ways of life. And, we saw that on 9/11. We saw it, in other parts of history. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Garrett, I think that what we did, and primarily what the Israeli Defense Force did during those 12 days, was to destroy Iran's ability to project power. And they had three ways that they did it. They had the threat of a nuclear program that I agree with the Institute for Science and International Security that it's been effectively destroyed. They had a ballistic missile program that now is 20% of what it was before the war started because of what Israel did. And they had this proxy network, the largest state sponsor of terrorism. And now Iran lacks the credibility and the finances to support that network. So I think the fact that they have been degraded in those three areas makes humanity a whole lot safer than we were before the war started. The second thought is that the Ayatollah, like I said in the answer previous, has an incentive to negotiate. And we should force the negotiation not just about the nuclear program, but about ballistic missiles and the proxy network. But he has an incentive to negotiate for his own regime survival, and I think that he will do so. And then finally, a third thought with respect to domestic safety is that secure borders are a necessary part of our national security and internal security. I think we've seen the resurrection of secure borders in the last 6 months or so, but I also very much praise our law enforcement community here in the United States for the vigilance that they have in keeping us safe every single day. And I know that there would love to be, the adversary would love to have a terrorist strike on the United States. And frankly, the only thing that is standing between us and them is keeping them at bay with our military, securing our borders, and then having a strong law enforcement presence within the United States. And fortunately, right now, I believe we have all three of those elements, which should keep us safe here as we protect humanity from abroad via the mechanisms that I talked about previously.
Of course, of course. And you have served in the U.S. Air Force and you were part of the Space Force. When you have served in or during multiple administrations, how much does policy change? And when I say that, of course, policies change and are implemented, throughout different administrations, from one administration to the next. But specific missions or, philosophies or ideologies or just the commands or the directions from your superior officers when they're relaying information from the president or wherever a military presence is. But in terms of like the oath that you took when you became commissioned officer and defending the Constitution of the United States and serving the United States and helping fellow Americans stay safe, being vigilant, obviously going after enemies, foreign and domestic, protecting the homeland, protecting our interest abroad. So how much does that really change from administration to next, in your opinion?
Garrett, there's two answers to that. The first one is at the base level and below. And at the base level and below, we have these incredible Americans that are all volunteers that are supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States. And you almost see no change in what your day-to-day activity is in doing your mission at the base level and below when you change of administrations, change administration. You almost don't see any difference because you're so focused on your particular mission and being an expert at that mission and making sure that you're lethal and ready to go at a moment's notice that you don't see much change. When you're in the Pentagon, it's a bit different because the Pentagon is a bit of a fusion of the military and the political leadership together. And so you actually very directly do see a change in the attitude of what's going on and the focus and the priority of what's going on when you're in the Pentagon as you change administration to administration. And then because of that, while that doesn't much filter down into the base level, you see a little bit of it, but not much. It does filter up. And what I mean by that is that when you have a military that's focused on both strength of capability and strength of will, then now it keeps adversaries at bay. But when you lack either strength of capability or strength of will to use that capability, you lose deterrence. And that is when adversaries are enticed to do the types of things that would be harmful to the United States, our allies and partners, and humanity. So it definitely does matter at the Pentagon level and up what is going on in the administration. But one thing that I think is often reassuring is that idea that 99 plus percent of the force that is at the base level and below doesn't feel much of a change of administration to administration.
And that makes perfect sense. And you talk about attitudes and philosophies. And again, you start our podcast talking about, from a GDP perspective, how much is lost when you don't have this apparatus, or you don't have the infrastructure in place, or you don't have people who are either doing their jobs to their full potential, or if there is a vacancy, if you will, of certain roles that are not filled. And that's why it's so important to make sure that when it comes to our US military and all the branches of the military, that you have the best fighters in the world, you have the best intelligence in the world, you have the best, that obviously our military can do to train our next generations of leaders. And it is interesting from one administration to the next that you pretty much have the same arsenal, or you have the pretty much the same capabilities and the military might at your disposal. But from a policy perspective or from a philosophies perspective and whether one administration is going to be more reactive opposed to proactive or vice versa. So it is interesting to get your perspective because you've lived it and you've been a part of serving in the military under administrations, whether Democrat or Republican. So I really appreciate that knowledge.
No, and Garrett, it goes back to teamwork. It really does. That less than 1% of our country is serving in the military, less than 1%. But they're all volunteers and they all did it for a reason. And maybe some of those reasons are slightly different, but one of those reasons is a belief in the goodness of our country and a willingness to sacrifice your own well-being to be part of a team to serve that country. And I think that it's easier maybe for us in the military to develop relationships and create a team because of the self-selected nature and the higher purpose that infuses that self-selected nature of our team. But going back to that $9 trillion loss because of global employee disengagement, that all leaders in all venues need to be very intentional, like I've said probably 5 or 6 times in this podcast, in developing teams and building relationships, because that is how you unlock that individual talent and unleash the teams of which you are a part.
And I really appreciate you saying that because, you know, we need obviously more engagement and less disengagement. And I think that, and I believe that when you are fully engaged in your profession, whether it's the military, whether in business or whether it's sports or whether it's working at a news network or whomever, a medical doctor who has to perform surgery, you have to be fully engaged in what you're doing. And you have to subscribe to what relationship building is, because not only do you have to be fully engaged, but part of that engagement is knowing how you interact and are successful with your peers and knowing whose contribution and what that contribution will entail to make sure that it's a successful mission. And you have to really know everybody else's roles, not just your own. And my family and my wife's family, my wife's grandfather retired as a colonel in the US Army. My uncle and grandfather, one of my uncles and one of my grandfathers served in the Army. And my grandfather on my father's side, his first cousin served under General George Patton, and he was in the tanks in Europe. So we come from a long line of military on both sides of the family. So it gives me great pride, and it's an honor and a privilege to interview with you, not only having family members who have served, but also interacting with military, whether current or retired, because I find what you all have to say is to be so incredibly insightful, and you exude with passion and love for country, that we all have a love for country. But you in particular, and whether it's my friend Shelley Brunswick, and whether it's military members of my wife's family or my family, it's a different level of service. I mean, it's a higher calling that you receive when you're younger. And you talk about top 1%. You know, there's a top 1% of people in this country who are, or in the 1% who have served, just like they say in the National Football League, only the top 1% of athletes get to the NFL level. But when it comes to your level and when it comes to the levels of the people you have served with, that is like the NFL level of the US military. And it's a big part of it, but it's not so much about the intellect. Or yes, drive matters and passion matters and wanting to do it. You know, you, when you saw the movie Top Gun, that changed your life and you were inspired to be in a position like that. But there is a calling from above, you know, and God has a lot to do with it, that in your mind, something just tells you, it's a light switch where something tells you, or God tells you, hey, this is what I need to be doing, or this is what I should be doing. And I firmly believe that we're all destined for, you know, great, amazing things, that, you know, God puts us on this earth for a reason, to be able to serve our life's purpose through his image, through his eyes, to be able to, you know, give back to our community, serve our country, and do whatever we can to live a selfless, purposeful life. And I'm sure you fully believe that.
I do, Garrett. And thank you for answering your calling to a higher purpose by producing this podcast. I think it's vital for our community, our society, to understand the importance of teamwork and relationship building. And it all does stem from a higher purpose and calling. And I appreciate that you answered that call in creating this podcast. In this stage of my life, I do a lot of helping develop the leaders our nation needs. And so if there's ever anything that I can do for your listeners or viewers, they can reach out to me on johntyker.com. I've got 3 books that I've written out there. I do keynote speaking, but really, I just want to continue to be part of a community like you are, Garrett, in helping people to understand the value of relationship building and teamwork.
Thank you so much for saying that. Really appreciate it. And you mentioned your 3 books. Feel free to share a little bit about each one and what inspired you to write them.
Yeah, absolutely. I first started, the first book is called Boom. The subtitle is Leadership That Breaks Barriers, Challenges Convention, and Ignites Innovation. And it actually is the story of the journey when I showed up to Command Edwards Air Force Base, of it being a bureaucratic quagmire and disaster. And at about 6 months, really with a focus on leadership of team building and relationship building, we created it into the most innovative organization in the United States Air Force. So that's Boom. I have a 90-day Christian devotional entitled Prayers for a Nation that helps people understand how they can pray for our country and our leaders. And then just a week ago or so, I published a kid's book, The Dragon Who Earned His Wings. It's about a dragon whose wings wouldn't fly on their own, so he joined the Air Force to learn how to fly. But like I said, I do a lot of speaking in various forums on leadership, innovation, advanced technology, national security, and international affairs. And if there's something I can ever do for one of your listeners, reach out to me at johntyker.com, and I'd love to be a help.
Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. And for my listeners and viewers at home, please reach out to Brigadier General John Tykert, who would be more than happy to assist you with your needs, or if you have professional endeavors and you want to partner with John, that would be wonderful. And Brigadier General John Tykert, my 74th guest on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. Thank you so much, John. I look forward to staying in touch with you and having many more conversations in the future.
Garrett, that sounds great. Congratulations on number 74, and I look forward to the next 74 from you.
Yes, thank you so much, Brigadier General John Tyker. Have a wonderful day. God bless, and thank God for our troops who are stationed here and abroad, who keep us safe and protect us from enemies foreign and domestic.
God bless the United States of America. You got it, Garrett.
Take care. Have a good one.